different. I would like to, I'll stick my neck out and allow some moments at the end of the study for questions. And do it, if we have enough time on the tape, you can let the tape go on, and I'll try to remember to repeat the question, and then those listening by tape can benefit from that, assuming that I can answer the question. If I can't, I'll tell you no, and I'll study real hard this week and try to answer next week. So keep that in mind if you have a question, perhaps on last week's study or something that comes up tonight. All right, Genesis in chapter 4. Genesis 4. Let me put this diagram of Genesis up. And get in your mind the basic movements in this book. What God is teaching us through the book as it unfolds. The story, creation, the story of the fall. Now we come to the third story, that of the flood. And chapters 4 and 5 and 6 are leading us up to that. The account of Cain and Abel, the cemetery chapter 5. These events are calculated by the Spirit of God to give us the necessary background to appreciate this great cataclysm that befalls the earth, the universal flood. Before we go into verse 8 of chapter 4, let's commit this time to the Lord. And Father, we ask that as we handle this portion of your word, and may our hearts be receptive, and may we understand how our relationship should be to the world, as we see that the world system does have some things to offer by way of technology, invention, culture, and we must be perceptive to know what's right and wrong, to know what to use and what not to use, and grant us a better understanding of our world and how can we be like an Enoch and walk with you and a Noah, living in a world that by and large lives as if you were not alive. So Father, show us how we are to carry ourselves, how the nobility of our union with Christ can be exemplified in our daily life. Do that for us in the name of Christ. Amen. Now last week we saw the story of Cain and Abel down through verse 7. We've come to verse 8, where after God has reprimanded Cain, told him that if he would confess his sin, he can once again have fellowship restored with himself, with God. If he does not deal with sin, it is crouched and will pounce upon him like a lion, and the effects or the consequences of sin will utterly devour him. So verse 8, what does Cain do? He doesn't listen, and we have the record of the offense. And Cain told Abel, his brother, and it came to pass, what did he tell him? I don't know. It doesn't say. Did he work out some kind of a rendezvous and had this all premeditated? But it simply says, and it came to pass that they were in the field, and that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. So Cain butchered him. How did he do it? Perhaps with the sacrificial knife and cut him. The word in 1 John that's used to describe this event would lead us to believe that it was the cutting of his throat with a knife. And this is how he slew him. So Cain killed him. And our word in the Greek in 1 John 3:12 is phazo, means literally to cut the throat. But by whatever manner, he's butchered Abel. Now the sentence, the consequences of this sin. I hope you've seen how sin works. It started out as an act of unbelief, that Cain was not bringing the right offering, he was bringing it with the wrong attitude. It doesn't say that something was intrinsically wrong with his sacrifice, like the first fruits, or the fruit. It doesn't say that he brought first fruits. But the mere fact that it wasn't a bloody sacrifice is not stated or commented upon. But the fact that he did not bring it by faith. Now, that's so important. I want you to look at the passage where that is mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, just for a moment. I know we studied this last week, but let me bring it up again, please. Was it because he did not bring a bloody sacrifice? Nowhere does it say that. It simply says that it was not by faith that he brought the sacrifice. That's the heart of the issue. We're talking about 11:4 in Hebrews. By faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice. See, it was the attitude with which he brought it, out of love for God. It was an expression, it was a heartfelt expression of his love for God. And so in that manner he brought it. It was a better sacrifice than was brought by Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts, and through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. And I'll comment on that in a moment. So there is the account of the sacrifice in its nature, that it was by faith. Then we have the account in verse 9 of God coming, speaking to Cain. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" Now, we've seen already that God is not seeking information. He asked Adam, "Adam, where are you?" God is omniscient. He's not fishing for information that he doesn't have. This is a teaching method. And God is asking this for a very good reason. He wants to remind Cain that he knows where Abel is. It's a way of teaching his omniscience in a reverse way. What do you think Cain's attitude would be? Well, you know where he is. And he is teaching Cain this lesson. So where is Abel, your brother? And I think he probably is eliciting some kind of confession in the process as well. Now Cain's response. And he said, "I know not." Now he's added into this growing cluster of sins what? I mean, we've seen unbelief. We've seen jealousy. We've seen hatred. We've seen anger. We've seen the act of murder. Now what? A lie to cover it. So sin is breaking out all over the place because it was not, he did not handle it to begin with like he should have. So now it's a lie. He tries to cover it up. Am I my brother's keeper? The Hebrew puts the verb here before brother, and it comes out something like this. Keeper of my brother. The word keeper is underscored in this sense that Cain is acting insolently like, is it my responsibility to keep up with him? So you see in Cain's attitude here, don't you see something about the way sin is, I shouldn't say developed, because once sin entered the human race, it had all these evils right there in the human heart. When Cain was born, it had the capacity for all this. Adam did. But in terms of the person, it's becoming more, you see a process of degradation. You're seeing the preparation for the floods, what you're seeing. You're getting a picture of Romans 1 and how sin works its deadly influence throughout a number. How with one, it goes out to the children. Look, mothers and fathers, you know one of the tragedies of our sins? Not that it affects us, true, directly, in our relation to God, but it affects our children and multiply the effects with our children. You'll see this when we go through Genesis. You'll find children picking up the sins of their fathers and their mothers, and you know what you see too? You see them even doing so a better job of it. In that you see them, the sin is even worse in their transaction. Now look what Cain's doing here. He's insolent. He's hardened. Adam was, well, he was reticent, and he was not haughty, at least. He was certainly guilty. But look what Cain's doing here. He's insolent, he's hardened, he's indifferent, and he's evading his responsibility to someone else. Now, we saw Adam shifting the blame. What's Cain now doing? He said, "It's not my responsibility." So you even see it going a step further. Parents, watch out. Those sinful habits have their influence on my children. And I might can learn a lesson from my children. If I see sinful habits in my children, you know one of the things I should do? I might ought to go take a look in the mirror, and then I may ought to get on my knees and do some self-examination and check it in my life. Do they complain because I complain? K can they not discipline themselves because I cannot discipline myself? So allow their own sin to be a way of thinking about yourself in a different way. Well, here's Cain. And he said, what hast thou done? Now the question is asked, of course, to underscore the horrible nature of this. He says, the voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. Now this is a figure of speech. It's a very impressive figure of speech. How is this blood crying from the ground? Is it actually saying something? Well, no, of course, it's not literally saying something. But it's crying in the sense that it's crying out for vengeance. It's crying out for justice. 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 The word for blood here, interesting in the fact that it's in the plural, looks like this in the Hebrew. It is deme. Deme. It's plural. Bloods crying out. I'm not suggesting translate it that way, but that's the literal rendering of it. Bloods. And it underscores the many drops shed. It underscores the evil nature, the despicable nature of this crime. Here was Cain taking the life of someone created in the image of God. And God views murder as a serious matter, so serious, that is why in Genesis 9:5, he lays down a strict guideline for government in dealing with murder. Now, human viewpoint thinks the opposite of the violence, the evil of murder. How does the average sentimental human viewpoint person think about a murderer? Don't kill him. That's awful. Oh, that's no respect for life to kill a murderer. That's the opposite of what God says. The life they have taken is so valuable that their life should be taken to draw attention to what they have done in an act of murder. That's God's viewpoint. Now, you catch the bleeding hearts, and we'll work the bleeding hearts over when we get to Genesis 9. But that is what should be done. And their death cries out for justice. Now, God hasn't established a vigilante approach to it. That's why in Romans, he says on the one hand, vengeance is mine. But then he tells government, you have been appointed for vengeance sake. People who want to make an issue out of the vengeance factor in Romans, it's Romans and the end of the 12th chapter in this. And when you get into the 13th chapter, he says he's appointed government to carry out his vengeance toward the murderer, to the evildoer. Well, God looks upon murder as a serious matter. His blood cries to me from the ground. Now, you recall in the passage we saw a moment ago, and in Hebrews 12:24, it says that Abel's blood, as Abel's blood cries out, the blood of Christ cries out. Well, what does the blood of Christ cry out for? His blood cries out, forgiveness, 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 pardon, pardon. Abel's blood cried out, judgment, judgment, judgment. And the blood of Christ, his work, cries out, here is forgiveness, here is forgiveness, here is forgiveness. It's a vivid way of showing what the work of Christ offers to those who look and respond with a look of faith. Verse 11, and now cursed art thou from the ground. Now this cursing from the ground, meaning he's being driven away from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand. So God now is shaping the punishment to fit the crime. And the punishment is going to be a continual reminder of the nature of the crime as the blood was shed on the ground. So Cain now will find it impossible to be a farmer, to cultivate the soil. Adam found it difficult. Cain will find it impossible. So it's a special kind of judgment for him. So he says, verse 12, when you cultivate the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. You shall be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. And the two words in the Hebrew sound not very long. You can write them down easily enough. But it's quite a sound to them. He says you're going to be a nach, that's a banished one, and you're going to be an av. It's like this. That's in a and in a d. A nach and an av. You're going to be a nach and an av. You're going to be a wanderer, like a gypsy, as it were. You're going to be a vagrant. You're not going to be able to stay and really work any living out of the ground. You're not going to be successful in that sense. So Cain's curse is twofold. First part of it is that he'll be separated from productive farming. Secondly, he's going to be separated from a permanent place. He's going to be a continual wanderer. He'll be a fugitive or banished and homeless. What's Cain's response to this? You know, it's not too late for him to repent, is it? No, he can. He can repent, and he can turn cursing into blessing. But what does he do? He does what a sinner quite often will do, even when they're faced with the consequences of their sin. Cain said unto the Lord, he says, my punishment is too great to bear. What is Cain most concerned with here? Cain is more concerned with the consequences than he is the nature of his sin. He is more concerned about what he personally is going to have to suffer than God's own character and his violation of the command of God. So he's saying, it's just too much for me. And then he complains, a typical response to a sinner who will not confess. He complains, and the insinuation is God is being unfair. He says, behold, now that, or thou hast driven me out of this day from the face of the ground, and from thy face shall I be hid, and I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer in the earth, and it shall come to pass that whosoever findeth me will slay me. The way of the transgressor is hard. But is he worried? He's worried about his own skin. He's a coward. And he reacts here like a coward would act. Is now he's thinking about what might happen to him as a result of what he's done. And so, as a result, we see the consequences of Cain's sin. He wouldn't face up to his guilt. He only wanted relief from the consequences, but he wasn't willing to remedy it. So jot this down in your notes. It is possible to want to do away with the consequences of sin in one's life, but not get to the source of the consequences. Do you get that? It's possible for a person to be hurting so bad, and they want to get rid of the consequences, but they aren't willing to go to God. I've seen this. I remember speaking to a gentleman once, and he was being hurt. It was a marriage that had lasted for years. And now such grief, it was falling apart, just breaking open right after all these years, and it was just going to pieces. And he was broken up. But in the process, I tried to get him to see that you've got to get down to the source of all conflicts in your life and problems. Listen, you need Jesus Christ. Do you know him? But you know what I found out? I didn't find an interest in that at all. But I found rather, how can I get her back? What can I do to ease the pain? What can we do to work in this? And it was in his own mind, apparently, that this was inconsequential. This was the most consequential. How can I relieve the consequences? But he wasn't willing to go to the source. It's like a child, and they get something stuck. I get a briar or a piece of glass, and it means that you're going to have to take a needle, sterilize it, and work it out. Oh, they'd rather you maybe put something on it so it wouldn't hurt. Put a Band-Aid on it and something to keep the pain away. But to sterilize that needle and to dig it out, no, that hurts. And quite often, people are this way. They want to do something to minimize the pain of the consequences, but they won't go to the heart of it. And that's what Cain's doing here. So, Cain is worried about what will happen to him. The Lord said to him, verse 15, so the Lord said, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. Namely, seven times as heavy a punishment will come on that person as Cain has received. And the Lord appointed a sign for Cain, lest anyone finding him should slay him. Now let's watch this carefully. He's not saying he puts a sign on him or in him. That's a misunderstanding. The word, and I'm going to be a little technical with you. I'll put the Hebrew, and I want to show you something about this word. Here is toucan or forcan. It looks like this in the Hebrew, and I want to show you the preposition that's used. And here's where the way it comes out. Le ka yin. Alright, this here, prefix, that's a preposition. Le. Right there. Translating it for. Not in, not on. For. It is showing, it is saying that this is a token or a pledge. Mark, I think, is a little confusing if you translate it that way. What God does is he is appointing or gives to Cain an assurance. He reassures Cain with some kind of pledge that no one will take Cain's life. He'll live his life out and die in, well, we might say, a natural manner. So this is a pledge from God of safe conduct. It's a picture of God's grace to the unbeliever. And it is a beautiful demonstration of the grace of God in the cross. And I think perhaps it's an indication of what we studied this morning in Romans 5, 13, and 14. God was not, what, counting their sins against them? God didn't. The question is, why didn't God take Cain's life? I refer you to Romans 5, 13, and 14 as one answer. So, God established this. I've heard some rather wild suggestions as what this Cain, the sign of Cain was. God put some kind of burning iron and put a number on his head, or, well, on and on and on. But it's saying that he appointed a pledge to Cain, lest any man finding him should smite him. So it was a reassurance to him that his life would not be taken in that manner. Now what happens? Verse 16, we have the record of Cain and his descendants. Now watch this section very carefully down through verse 24. That here we have the record of the first civilization. And some things become immediately apparent. We do not have a picture here of a lot of so-called Neanderthal-type men, women, going around with grunts and with a primitive, almost animal-like existence. We have a picture here of a civilization that advances rapidly. Technology. We find culture developing. Music. We find metalsmiths, blacksmiths. So we find a culture that develops rapidly, in my own opinion, is that it develops into a very high kind of culture, a very advanced kind of culture. I'll even go so far as to say this. Ancient man had greater brilliance than modern man. I've told you this, haven't I, that evolution has led modern man to have some erroneous thoughts about himself. So evolution has assumed that we're getting better and man is smarter than he used to be. Also, evolution it results in man having an unfounded pride in himself today. You hear this quite frequently. It's just almost like the air. You hear it so much, it's just like breathing. And this is the philosophy of the world, that man's going to the moon, for instance, is looked upon as being some great achievement in contrast to our existence once upon a time in this primeval state, and man learning to build fires, and then man learning what a wheel was, and then finally we see man going to the moon. And what's next for man and all his brilliance? Well, evolution leads us to some wrong assumptions about man. So when man comes upon some of the ancient so-called mysteries, we have people run around want to tell us that spaceships have been here, people from other planets, and a lot of people go in for these fads, and they try to explain how, can't even explain how the pyramids were made, and that isn't even as old as the Genesis record here. Well, I'm simply saying that this first civilization was advanced, very advanced, more than we'll ever be able to know, because all of the features of it results were wiped out completely in the flood. But let's see what happens. And this also is an account of the world developing. You know, John uses that term, 1 John, the world system. Well, here it is. And let's comment as we go along. And Cain went out from the presence of the Lord. Now, going out from the presence of the Lord, I think it means he goes out from the special manifested presence of the Lord. The fellowship is lost, and he's now out in this self-sufficiency, this independence that he wanted. Am I my brother's keeper? Okay. He's getting this independence, and let's see how he enjoys and experiences his newfound freedom. Well, you know what? You know how the story's going to end, don't you? The flood. There's man in his freedom for truth wherever he may find it, and out on his own and not obligated to God and not taking on responsibility for anyone else but himself, the big I. All right, we'll see where it's ending. So we're building the flood. Keep that in mind. And Cain went out from the presence of the Lord, and he dwelt in the land of Nod. It's the Hebrew, or Nod, on the east of Eden. We can't find this place because Eden was destroyed in the flood, but it's the area. The word Nod means banishment, an area of wandering. So this is the area in which he wandered as a part of his curse. And Cain had relations with his wife, and she conceived and gave birth to Enoch. And he built a city, called the name of the city Enoch, and after the name of his son. Now there is one of those, that question that is often asked, that I guess we might as well muse upon it for a moment. Where did Cain pick up this wife? Because if you read the text, you don't read anything thus far about people other than Adam, Eve, Cain, and Abel. Four people. But our problem is this. We fail to remember that the Bible is not giving us a history of the world. It is not giving us a history of civilization, past, present, and future. It's accurate in all its records. But what the Bible doesn't say, it does not tell us how many other children. Was this possible? Could have been possibly a sister of Cain? Oh, you say, oh, the problems genetically, that's incest. Think back. Now, I don't know all that much about genetics, but I know this much. Think of the enormous gene pool in Adam and Eve. See, the problems we have now because of the mutational possibilities in a limited gene pool within a family. But you didn't have this in early civilization. So it could have been a sister, it could have been a niece, it could have been a grandniece. There's just so much we aren't told about other people, for Cain has already said, somebody's going to kill me. So apparently there was an expanding population at the time. And these ancients and these antediluvian people, they were living hundreds and hundreds of years. So there's just so much that we don't know, but it could have been one of those three situations. They bare Enoch, and he built a city. First city on record, not necessarily the first city, but it's the first one mentioned in the Bible. Now, to Enoch was born Irad. I'm going to put something up that'll help us through this list of names, and we'll begin to make some contrast, make some identification. Now, the very top of this diagram I have on the screen for you, I've taken it all the way down for 1,000 years. This doesn't take us down to the flood on the basis of these ages, but close to it. If you took, and, well, I'm getting into that in the fifth chapter, so let me hold off on that. I want you to see the children and the two lines that begin to develop. What we have here coming down from Adam, with Cain, Enoch, Irad, Mahujael, and Methusael, and Lamech, and his sister, and so forth, is that you have two kinds of civilizations, or maybe a better way, you have a civilization developing, but you have two kinds of people in this civilization. This right here becomes what we're told in 1 John, the world system. Not everything in the world system is bad. They go out and they make instruments of music. They go out and they make weapons, not necessarily good, not necessarily bad. It depends on how they're used. But now you'll see some contrast between the descendants here, Abel, and then the one God gives to him in his place, to Adam and Eve in his place, Seth, Enosh, and so forth. Watch for these contrasts that come out. All right, he builded a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. That name is interesting, and I'll try to point this out as we go along, that these names are significant, and it seems to me for the most part they are. This name, Enoch, means inauguration or initiation. Perhaps in the process now, Cain is named in such, looking on this as a new initiation or new inauguration of a new era in his life. And so the name bears that idea. Mahujael means smitten of God. Became the father of Methushael, means man of God. See, I'm not saying that these people in this line weren't believers. They could have been. We aren't told. We have to be careful even their names, so their meaning. And Methushael became the father of Lamech. Now, we want to keep our eye on Lamech. And Lamech, his name means powerful, took to himself two wives. The name of the one was Ada, which means beautiful or adorned. And the name of the other was Zillah, means tinkling or ornament. So they must have been, if the names indicate something, it's saying something about their beauty and the way they adorn themselves. And Ada gave birth to Jabal. His name means production. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal, which means sound. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and the pipe. It's an early form of the harp, of the flute. As for Zillah, she had Tubal-Cain, whose name means graceful or beauty. Before I go further and we look at Lamech's sword song here, the first piece of poetry on record, the first song on record, let's go back now and let's make a contrast of, shall I call it two civilizations? Let's see a contrast that begins to develop here between these two. And I'm going to pick up a little bit of something from Genesis 5, but we can learn something here between the contrast between Genesis 4 and 5. On the one hand, we have this record in the line of Cain. We have the world system and its culture. What we call the world system and its culture. We have the record of Enoch building a city. Doesn't say that it's an evil city. I don't want to overdraw my point. Doesn't say that cities are evil. What's that old line? God made the country and man made the city. Well, that's ridiculous. If you're trying to draw some kind of spiritual application from it, I don't think that. It depends on what kind of city it is. God also is building a city, as far as that goes, the New Jerusalem, to live in it forever. So cities are not intrinsically evil. But nevertheless, we find a culture being established in a city. Over here, we're going to find a special attention drawn to God's people. And we'll get an Enoch over here, won't we? Now, you keep the Enoch separate, and we're going to have two Lamechs as well. And it's almost as if there's a very clear intention by the Spirit of God to draw attention to these contrasts. Similarity in names, but difference in lifestyles. But over here, we're going to have an Enoch. And attention won't be drawn to the fact that he was a city builder, but what? And he walked with God. He walked with God. It almost seems that we have a contrast here between those who lived only for secular pursuits and those who lived for spiritual pursuits. Values, values, values. That's it. And then secondly, we're going to see Lamech over here in the line of Cain. And what will we see about Lamech? Oh, Lamech, the braggart. And you'll see it in his song. Oh, how typical he is of people and singers and songs today. He is the braggart. Over here we'll get a Lamech. You'll see him in chapter 5. Another Lamech. And what's he going to do? He's the father of Noah. And he names his son in hope of perhaps, maybe Noah can be Messiah. I believe he expected it. At least that Noah could be one who could provide deliverance from what was a continuing and a growing depraved world. And it was pressing in on these people. And it seems that godly people were increasingly becoming the minority, and the ungodly were increasing in numbers. Three, we have on this side, Cain's civilization, people living without God, and even going on with normal pursuits, like building, planting, and eating, and music. That's worldliness. You see what worldliness is? It's engaging in legitimate pursuits without any mind for God. A Christian can be worldly and not be engaging in what we might think of as sinful habits, simply living without God. That's worldliness. So here's without God, and over here, of course, we find an Enoch, a Noah, walking with God. Fourthly, we find over here in this world system benefits enjoyed as a result of advancement in civilization. Music, instruments by which to work, with which to work. And what do we have over here? Benefits of civilization, instruments with which to work. Same thing. Nothing wrong. This system. These men can enjoy the developments made in civilization. There's nothing wrong with that. And five, what happens? Death over here. And we're going to see a contrast. Now, there's the exception. Death is the rule for even those over here. But we're going to see an exception, aren't we? It's almost as the Spirit wants us to see something about these people that, sure, death happens to the most. But we get just a little glimpse by God just taking Enoch right out without death. Just we're kind of teased a little bit about that. If you didn't have the rest of Revelation, of Scripture, and you read this, and he was not, God took him. Took him. Where'd he go? Spaceship come get Enoch? You see it coming down now. No. So we're going to get this contrast. All right, let's go further. And verse 18. Let's go down to the sword song and let's study that. Verse 23. And Lamech said to his wives, he has a captive audience, that's who he has to brag to here. I don't think a lot of Lamech. I think he was a lot of hot air, and I think he was just trying to throw his weight around. He was a big bully. We know that because he's out here whipping up on little boys, and he's just totally obnoxious. And Lamech said unto his wives, Ada and Zillah. Now watch the poetry. You can see it in the new ASV if you have that. It's laid out for you. You can see the rhythm of the thought patterns here. Ada and Zillah, listen to my voice, you wives of Lamech. Give heed to my speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me. This is somebody bumped into him on the street one day and he killed him. And a boy for striking me. The word for boy here, a mere lad, a child. What do you think about a guy like that? Here he's captive audience with women, picking on women and children. Here's the first arch villain. Well, Cain fits that caricature as well, that description, but here's Lamech. You see something in this story about Lamech? Let's think back in what the Spirit of God is wanting to see by this progress in civilization. We start with Adam. What did Adam do? He says, tries to shift blame. What does Cain do? He refuses to accept any responsibility. What do you find Lamech doing now? you find Lamech saying, my total responsibility is myself. And anybody who gets in my way, look out. And if Lamech isn't the epitome of the kind of person that lives in a godless society, no fear of God, arrogant, he exalts in his sin, he flaunts his actions. Adam ran and hid. Cain, he cringed. He didn't want to leave the presence of God. True, he was worried about the consequences. But what's Lamech doing? He's flaunting his sin. Anybody gets in my way, I'll kill him. That's what I'll do. Because, look, I'm living for one person, and the only way you're going to have happiness is to look out for the big eye. Isn't that what the world's saying? Say, you've got to learn to love yourself. You've got to... Listen, if you don't look out for you, who's going to look out for you? You owe it to yourself to be happy, and on and on and on it goes. That's the world system. And it's always putting its pressure to shape you into its mold. This is quite a picture of the world system described for us in Romans. The world, Romans 12:2. Here it is. So here is a Lamech. You'll notice that here's the first record of the violation of the divine pattern for marriage, too. He violates the divine pattern for marriage. Now, it may have happened before, but this is the first on record. And listen to this. Nowhere in the Old Testament is polygamy condoned by God. Some people try to look to the patriarchs and say, well, look, Abraham had this many wives. They sinned. That's what they did. And they paid for it, too. You cannot break God's order and get away with the consequences. And Lamech is the first one on record of defying this divine order. And we have this follow-up in verses 25 and 26. And Adam had relations with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth. For she said, God has appointed me another offspring, and Seth means appointed one, another offspring in the place of Abel, for Cain killed him. So let's look again at our two lines. And what we'll see develop now from the line of Seth, who supplanted Abel. And contrast this with the line of Cain, and epitomized in a person like Lamech. And then we'll compare that over here with the line of Abel and people like an Enoch and like another Lamech and Noah himself. Keep that contrast in mind. Verse 26, and to Seth, to him also was a son born, and he called his name Enosh. Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. You know what Enosh means? Comes from a verb that means to be weak, means to be frail, mortal. These names seem to me to be just each of them preaching something. You remember what Adam and Eve called Kanim, Cain, acquired of the Lord? I get the feel from the play on words there that I think they really expected something quite positive from the birth of that son. We've got him with the help of the Lord. They were hoping for this deliverer in Genesis 3:15. And then what did they name the next son? Abel. Vanity. Breath. I think they begin to realize in something in Cain that it looks all vain, hopeless. And man's come to the point now where Seth names his son Enosh, maybe saying to us, attesting the fact that we find a civilization, even of the godly people, realizing their frailty, their mortality. See, death was something that was dawning on them in terms of its sin and its consequences. And they begin to see people die. Adam and Eve hadn't seen death until they saw those animals slain to clothe them. So they begin to see the consequences of sin break out around them. All right, now we walk through a cemetery. That's not a very pleasant way to end Sunday night, but we've got to take a walk through a cemetery. And we look at a lot of headstones, chapter 5. And what we have is, I think, a threefold purpose here in this chapter. It won't take long to cover it. But what we have here is an intended contrast to chapter 4. We have people and statements about them designed to show us a contrast to Cain and his way of life. We have the line of Seth given because it will be through the line of Seth that ultimately who will come? Messiah. Keep that in mind. It comes through so dramatically when you keep this in mind. God is showing us here how that the world, through this line, will come ultimately Messiah. Because here will come down Abel. He's killed. God puts in his place, appointed one, Seth. Then we go down the line from Seth. We get all the way to Noah. Noah has three sons. Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Who is the oldest? Not Shem. Japheth. Who is the youngest? Ham. Shem's first. Why? Because it will come through Shem, the Messiah. See, it's just narrowing down. We'll get narrowed down. Then we'll get to chapter 12, and we'll right down to Abraham, the seed. So that's what we're building toward. But right now we're building to the flood to show God's judgment on this world, why he had to judge it. So here's the walk through the cemetery. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. And he created them male and female, and he blessed them and named them man in the day that they were created. Now, emphasizing the unity of the race, they're both called Ha'avam here. And now he's going to demonstrate the reality of death. When Adam had lived, and I'm not going to read every one of these verses, but I want to show you something interesting about each of them. In every case, there seem to be at least four things said about them. One, their name. Two, the age of birth, at birth, just like looking down at a tombstone. Name, and then you get the age at the birth of the first son. How old he was at the birth of his first son. You get the length of the remainder of his life, and then the age of his death. Those four things. So we just clip right along. And here's the picture of Romans 5, 12 through 14, death reigned. I'll list those again. You get the name. You get the age of at birth of the first son, how old he was. The length of the remaining life, and the age at death. Now we see this. Adam, 930 years. Seth, 912 years. Enosh, 905 years. Kenan, 910 years. Mahalalel, 895 years. Jared, 962 years. Enoch, 365 and counting. He checked out at 365 and still going strong. Methuselah, 669. We make a lot of Methuselah because he's the oldest one on record, but it's incidental in the record. Enoch comes through as the more attention is given to him. Then we have a Lamech, 777 years. And then finally, Noah, 950 years. A couple of observations. You find 10 listed here. I think there's a good reason for that. We'll come to the 11th chapter, and you'll find in that genealogical table 10. If you took all these names and their ages, you would have 1,656 years from the time of Adam to the flood. However, there's some reason to believe, though, that there have been some intentional gaps left here. How much? I don't know. But you'll see that, I'll demonstrate this more when we get into the 11th chapter, that there are some gaps. And these 10 have been selected. And they'll take us down to Noah, because that's where we're in a hurry to get to. We'll get there next Sunday. But I want you to notice a couple of inserts about Enoch, number one. Then Enoch walked with God. That means he was walking about with God, having fellowship, 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah. He had other sons and daughters. Verse 24, Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. The word walked about, it means to live, to have fellowship with. This is what he was doing. It was a very close and intimate relationship. Take this in contrast to a Lamech in chapter 4. He was arrogant, defying God's pattern in marriage, and haughty. But here's a man who's enjoying fellowship. He's living by a different set of values. Then look over at verse 28 and 29. And Lamech lived 182 years, and became the father of a son. Now he called his name Noah. The name means rest, to lie down. This one shall give us rest, taken from a verb, Hebrew verb, which means to console, to bring comfort. From our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed. What do you think Why named Noah this, and what he was communicating in this name? Could he not have thought that Noah was the Messiah? It's possible that he thought that. They didn't have the time perspective we did. And I get this strong impression here that the world was getting to be increasingly a difficult place in which to live for God. The pressures were enormous. Wickedness is going to just, well, you'll see it in chapter 6. Wait till you break into the 6th chapter next week. You'll find out how bad it got. And pressures were getting so great that those who were trying to live for God are crying out. I didn't call your attention to the fact, I didn't mean to leave it out, that says men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Those were the first, that's mentioning the first formal acts of worship, public worship. Others worship, but that's when they begin to meet in groups to worship the Lord. But we find them having difficulties, pressures, because they're in the minority, and the world hates God, and their life is miserable, and the effects of the fall are all about them. Is Lamech coping Noah's the Messiah? At least through whom? Maybe Noah, something could happen through Noah. And so then it says, and Noah was 500 years old, and Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Japheth, through whom God's Messiah would come. That's why he's placed first. Oh, that's the walk through the cemetery, isn't it? You just look down through there, and he died. 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 Death reigned because of the sin of one man. It entered through Adam. But we're building now for the flood itself, chapter 6. We'll study that next Sunday night. Now, I'll stick my neck out some here. And are there any questions from what we've studied thus far in chapter 4? And if it's necessary to go all the way back to chapter 3. But anything particularly now up to this point? Any questions, something that not been made clear, I'd like to ask? Yes, Candy. All right, the question is it going to involve a great degree of difficulty to explain the gaps? No, I'll try to do this as best as I can when we get to the 11th chapter, for we have another genealogy, and what we will come to will be the whole issue of how much time elapsed. And don't think that by the mentioning of possible gaps, there is any leeway given to the millions of years that uniformitarian geology asks. No, it's at the most 1,000 years or so. We're not talking about enormous periods of time. I think this probably does give us some kind of a rough estimate of the time frame, but I will try to show you in which there are some intended gaps. These were, and the tenness here, I think, could very well have been for memory purposes. The Jews delighted in it, they'd memorized these genealogical tables. And when they grouped them in tens or other things, you see this even in the Gospels. You'll find some symmetry and order to those genealogies as well, certain numbers. We'll do that later. Any other questions? I thought I saw a hand somewhere else. Yes, John? Yes. No, public worship. Let's look over chapter 12 and verse 8. You'll find the next occurrence there. 12:8 says, I'll skip down to the end of the verse. And there he built an altar to the Lord, and he called upon the name of the Lord. So the question is what is this calling upon the name of the Lord? It's alerting us to the fact that public worship, coming together in groups and worshiping the Lord, started taking place at a very early date. And you've got other references, Psalm 116, verse 17, Jeremiah 10:25. So it's a declaration that formal worship, not private personal worship, but formal worship is taking place. I think another of those intended contrasts to the way the world system is generating. It's going about its routine six, and yet here there were those people who met together for worship of the Lord. Any other questions about this? Yes. All right. Is God still appearing in a theophany? That is, was he manifesting himself in some kind of special form to communicate with man like he apparently was doing with Adam and Eve? I don't know how God chose to do this. And was it an audible voice? Did he use a communicator? I don't know how. It could very well have been a theophany. Though it does seem that when a theophanies occur, that it's usually quite clear, and it isn't here. And exactly, was it an inner voice, an outer audible voice? I don't know. That's about the best we could do with that. Perhaps it just could be a very audible voice. Just, he hears it. God's still, like, I think I'm reminded of Samuel. And his voice, he hears the voice of God calling him, and he thinks it's Eli calling him. So it could have been in that fashion. Any other questions? Yes, Jody.
In chapter 3, you said that if Adam and Eve had passed the test,
yes,
they would have
made a firm covenant. Yes, if Adam and Eve had passed the test, they could have entered into another plateau or different, qualitatively different kind of relationship.
But wasn't it a test even before the serpent came? They could have known that tree was there for some time before the serpent.
The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Yes, they could have known that the tree was there and could have been tested. It could have been a test without Satan. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Yes, it could have been a test even if Satan hadn't made his appearance. Though I would imagine, looking at the total revelation on this matter, is that we're to know that Satan was alive and in existence and well at this time and wanted to bring in man under his authority. I think Satan wanted a piece of the action. And he wanted what God had given to man, rule. He couldn't have it in heaven, so now he tries to get it on earth. But, yes, it could have been a valid test because God had given them the command to not eat it. And even if there hadn't been Satan as an agent, they still would have had the test before them. It just became...
Yes, that test.
Yeah. Any other questions?
I'm confused how genealogically with Enoch. Jiving it with Luke chapter 3.
Yes.
There are two Enochs, right?
Yes. There's the Enoch here in the line of Cain, and there's the Enoch here in the line of Seth. The Enoch who built the city, verse 18, and then the Enoch who walked with God of chapter 5 and verse 22.
Are they usually spelled differently? One S-H and one C-H, the godly.
I don't...
S-H, looks like it is here.
Well, let's see. I have the new ASV, and they were both spelled Enoch, so I don't know why the difference in spelling other than translational factors. But I've got the new ASV, and they're both spelled E-N-O-C-H. And memory serves me correctly. I don't think there's any difference in the original. I can check that out. Yeah.
But they follow the line down through the ungodly line of Cain and Cain's Enoch. And Luke 3. And I was always under the impression that there was a godly line and an ungodly line. And you...
Well, when we say that, we have to be careful. And we're not saying in a godly line that everybody there necessarily was a Christian. Well, that's New Testament vocabulary. That everybody there was a believer. And we're not saying everybody here was an unbeliever. We're trying to differentiate two kinds of styles of living, in a sense. That seems to be clear. But there is the line through which God's appointed Messiah would come. And you'll find some rather embarrassing behavior as you go down the line. Well, you'll see it in Noah's case, among others. And so you'll see some behavior there that's certainly sinful. That doesn't mean they aren't a believer, but that's the line of the Messiah versus another offshoot.
Luke 3, Canaan, C-A-I-N-A-N, is Canaan back in?
Well, I would have to... I would guess so. I don't have Luke 3. I didn't look at it in preparation for this. I'd have to look at it. I'll look at it this week and see if I can any clarifications can be made on that. Some of these are spelling problems. They're the same. It's just that we've got some. It goes down to some translational, scribal differences, that kind of thing. Yes, Ken. I could, it could be. I'd have to look. Yeah, there is another Canaan, yeah, there in Luke. Yeah, all right, that would be the grand.